Tiny Cats, for the longest time, I had one movie on my to-watch list that was My White Whale. I had seen it lauded as one of the scariest movies ever, the best horror movie you've never seen, and so I was on the hunt. But it wasn't streaming anywhere in Canada. I couldn't find a physical copy of it anywhere here, so I'd resigned myself to never seeing it. Then I saw an announcement on Twitter that it was being released on Blu-ray by Second Sight Films. So, of course, I pre-ordered it, paid an obscene amount of money for a movie I had never watched, with shipping and exchange rate and all of that. And I assumed that the internet was not lying to me, that it was indeed an incredible film. That film was Lake Mungo. And let me tell you that even though it was not what I was expecting at all, this 2008 Australian film had a huge impact on me.
I feel like something bad is going to happen to me. It hasn't reached me yet, but it's on its way.
Family and friends, the normally tranquil setting of Ararat's mortal dam has shed Alice's heart to a young woman taken too soon.
10 days after Ellie's funeral, stuff started happening around the house. Sounds seemed to come from Ellie's old room.
They didn't really relate, so I thought, well, I'll just set up a camera to, see anything. I looked back and there was footage of a figure moving across the hallway.
The image was quite unsettling because it certainly looked like Alice.
I want you to close your eyes. I usually videotape my sessions. Something was happening inside that house and I wanted to find out what it was.
We checked the tapes.
There was a ghost in our house. Alice kept secrets. She kept secrets a secret.
Something bad is going to happen to me.
Alice knew she was going to die.
I feel like something bad has happened. It hasn't reached me yet, but it's on its way. And it's getting closer.
So I'm your host, Sherry. This is your friendly reminder that, as always, there will be loads of spoilers. So if you haven't seen the movie, go watch it. Otherwise, proceed at your own risk. So joining us today to talk about this movie are Derek and Jamie. Hey, folks.
Hello.
That was like almost perfectly in unison.
Jamie and I, we're like, you can't see what I'm doing, but I'm like pointing at the screen back and forth. Our brains are very similar.
I love it. That's awesome.
They are. We just like, even creatively and stuff, we're always like bang on, like on a wavelength of understanding. So it's really cool. It's really cool to meet people like that. So I'm blessed.
Very nice. So why don't you, Derek, you've been on before. You came on to talk about the Texas Chainsaw Massacre. Jamie, you're new to the show, but why don't you both take a second to introduce yourselves?
All right, Derek, you want to go first?
Sure. I am Derek Sykes. I am from Little Canada, Minnesota, which is a suburb of the Twin Cities, Minneapolis and St. Paul. I am a senior in the theater program at the University of Minnesota, the Twin Cities campus. I am, so into horror. I didn't really grow up watching horror a ton. But around high school, I got really into it, and it's just been such a fun, incredible journey into this genre ever since. I have been so, so blessed to meet so many cool people like Sherry and Jamie who share this passion for the genre online, on Twitter, RIP question mark. We are in what is possibly the final throes of Twitter, or it could just, still be there in a year or 2 years and we'll all look very silly. But either way, I feel so, so grateful to have been born when I was, that I could have access to this internet community of people who, may not agree on all the specifics, but have such a passion and a warm, open personalities that make it really nice to connect.
It really is. And I don't know that you find that in other, like, fandoms. Like, I feel like horror, to me, seems very unique that way.
Yeah, I will say the only other fandom in which I think there is truly, like, camaraderie of a sort, and it's even then, it's a little bit more of a, like, volatile camaraderie, where we're always, like, taking the piss out of each other, is the Survivor community, like the TV show Survivor. I just got into Survivor this September, and that, you know, has been another community, very fun, very loving, but definitely, like, you know, you gotta know your stuff, like, and if you don't, they're more than willing to point you in the right direction. But yeah, it's the horror community is really unique. I think maybe that's a reflection of the genre itself, because it's so varied and kind of undefinable.
I think that's a really good point. I think, like, horror is, there are so many movies that people will say, that's not a horror movie. But then somebody will say, that is a horror movie, and here's why. And you're right, it's very kind of nebulous. And I love that we can kind of each have our own opinions about what's a horror movie and what's not. And I mean, are there gatekeepers in horror? Of course. But the community of horror fans that I have seemed to found myself in are not that way, which is delightful. And yeah, I love that. Like, hey, if you like this, how about check out this movie, because it's, like, very similar and you might like the themes and vibes. And it, yeah, it's awesome.
Yeah. I mean, that's it. We don't need to retread too much. You should go back and listen to the episode I was on previously, because we're talking about what I think is the best horror movie of all time, The Texas Chainsaw Massacre, which is no shade to Lake Mungo whatsoever, by the way. We'll get into my feelings on Lake Mungo later, but it's more about my love for The Texas Chainsaw Massacre than any negative feelings I could possibly have about Lake Mungo.
I love it. Jamie, what about you?
Well, I'm Jamie Alvey. I am an educator by day. I teach college English and writing. I am a writer. I do both creative and analytical work. I have a theater degree, so I do some acting, and I just do a lot of different stuff. I'm all over the place, but I am happy to be all over the place. I am probably best known for the unproduced screenplay Bystanders, which I talk about every chance I get, because I know it's my project, but I'm obsessed with it. I feel like we should all be obsessed with our own work, because, again, who else is going to be if you're not going to invest in it yourself? So that's pretty much the rundown on me. But again, yeah, I'm really glad that I have found so many, like, good, genuine people out there that like horror as well, because I've always been one of those people. I'm very awkward sometimes, and I have trouble connecting with other people. And it's been nice to have a way to connect to people on such a just base level understanding, I guess, because I've met so many wonderful people. I met Derek, and I have had the honor of reading so many of Derek's, like, wonderful creative works. And it's just been really thrilling, though, to find other people that have the same passions that I do. And I love it. I love it a lot.
Awesome. Okay, well, we're going to subject you to the Scaredy Cat 5. So anytime a new guest comes on, we ask them some questions about, you know, their tastes in horror and that sort of thing. So Jamie, what is your favorite subgenre of horror?
Gothic.
Ooh, I love it. I think you're the first person to say that.
I'm not shocked there. not at all. So gothic is probably my favorite subgenre. And of course, I love, like, you know, I think this kind of goes in hand with, like, you know, I like paranormal horror quite a bit, like ghosts and stuff, but that goes hand in hand with the gothic. But I also like really, like, gritty, realistic horror as well, but gothic is, like, one of my niche horror passions.
I love that. Now, what is it, do you think, about gothic horror that, like, draws you in?
I've thought about this too. I just honestly I love these just kind of uncompromising plots that are sometimes bombastic. And there's just such a style and a flair to it that we that's not common in a lot of contemporary media. And it's just, there's just a flair and an elegance and a poetic quality about it that I'm really taken with. As you can tell, I was the kind of nerdy kid that read Wuthering Heights at 14.
Oh, yep. Yeah,
and I was sold. So I took that and I ran. And apparently Poppy wants to talk about Wuthering Heights.
I was also that child. And I will say, so when I was in, I think I was 15 or 16 at I would have been 16 at the time. There is a Canadian author named Jane Urquhart, and she wrote a book about the Bronte sisters, and like a fictional tale called Changing Heaven. And I decided I was going to cover this for one of my English classes, and I had to do a presentation on it. And I brought in my hamster and said that my hamster was my dog, because I was supposed to be Emily Bronte, who had a big dog. And I said, this was my dog, but in heaven, there are so many dogs that my dog had to shrink. That's why it's the size of a hamster now. Yeah, that was me. So, okay. So what is your favorite horror movie?
Oh gosh. Like off top of my head. And this is one that's been my favorite since I was literally like 14. Let the Right One In.
Excellent choice. What was the first horror movie you remember seeing?
The first one I remember clearly watching all the way through, and not, you know, freaking out too badly was the American remake of The Ring with my mother.
Oh, that's a scary one to watch for the first time.
It is, like, all the way through. I remember being like 10 or 11 and just mom was like, we're going to do it. And we did. And, the funniest thing happened. A telemarketer called at the same time the phone rang on screen. So it was, yeah, that was a memorable experience, needless to say.
I just showed my mom The Ring like 2 weeks ago. Holds up really well, by the way. It's a great remake.
It does. But yeah.
It was funny because like, you were talking about how your mom was like, we're going to do it. We're just going to sit and watch it. And that's exactly how I was with my mom. I was like, you know, we're just going to sit down. We're going to watch it. You promised you were going to watch a scary movie. Oh, yeah. We were watching it because it was late October. So I guess it was more than 2 weeks ago at this point. But
time's
she promised she was going to watch a scary movie with me. And ultimately, I picked The Ring because she vetoed a lot of other choices. And because I had just gotten the Steelbook that just came out, the 4K Blu-ray Ooh. Steelbook. And so it was serendipitous that the day I picked that up, I was like, okay, well, I just got this, so why don't we watch it? It had been a minute since I'd seen it, probably at least 2 years. And I was pleasantly surprised by how much I still really, really liked it.
Now, Jamie, does your mom like horror movies?
Oh, she loves them. Like, that's exactly where I got my introduction into the genre. My mother loves horror movies so much that people have just assumed that I was named after Jamie Lee Curtis. I'm not. I'm named after my father. He is James. I'm Jamie. But people are like, are you? Because when I'm like, yeah, my mom really loves horror movies. She loves the Halloween movies. They're like, are you named after Jamie Lee Curtis? No, I'm not. But it always makes for just a funny coincidence. And I talked to her about that. And I was like, did you subconsciously? And she's like, I don't think so. But here we are.
Maybe that just tipped it over. Like, she's like, well, I'm thinking about naming her after her dad, but, oh, you know what? Jamie Lee Curtis. Maybe that just tipped it over into, like, certainty.
I hope so. I'm going to ask her about that because I'm very, very honored to share a name with Jamie Lee Curtis. I mean,
as you should be. Derek, what about you? I'm assuming since you said your mom vetoed a bunch of choices, she's not a horror movie fan, or she's kind of...
She will never, ever admit it. She will go to her grave talking about how much she hates scary movies. But every time I show her a movie, she has a great time. I made her watch all 12 Friday the 13th movies. Sherry, actually, this was when you came on to my podcast to talk about...
Yes.
I think you were on to talk about Dream Warriors and Dream Master.
I was.
Yes, yes. We were covering the Nightmare movies and the Friday movies at the same time. And for our big ranking episodes, me and my co-host invited my mom and her dad to talk about each of the series individually. And so my mom watched all 12 Friday movies, complained about it the whole time, and then when we recorded the episode, she was like, but it was fun. And if a 13th one came out, I would watch it.
That's a ringing endorsement. I like it. That's
so
awesome.
I think she's like a sleeper fan. Like, you have to kind of bring it to her. But when you watch, when she, you know, finally watches it, like, I try and only show her really quality stuff. You know, like the Friday the 13th movies, famously the most quality horror franchise. But like, I showed her Suspiria, the remake of Suspiria. I showed her Daniel Isn't Real, The Ring, Crimson Peak. These are all movies that I was like, I think these are good enough where like she can, you know, get past the genre-ness of it a little bit perhaps. And she always, like I said, she always ends up agreeing. Oh, I showed her The Night House too, and she always has, you know, a good time and agrees. So I think she's a sleeper fan, but she'll never admit it.
I love that. My mom is not a horror fan and has only ever seen two horror movies in her life. One is Texas Chainsaw Massacre and the other is Rosemary's Baby, and she will never watch another one.
My mom loves Rosemary's Baby. Yeah.
My mom said she was traumatized by it. So.
Well, that's my mom with the Texas Chainsaw Massacre. So it's crazy that like it's my one of my all-time favorite movies and my favorite horror movie. And I went as Leatherface this year for Halloween, and she was talking about it, and she was like, never again, never again. She saw it once at a drive-in in like 1980, and she said, absolutely never again. She just specifically talks about like that ending sequence, you know, when Sally runs out of the house and Leatherface is swinging his chainsaw. And I was like, wow, she seems really really traumatized by this. And I think a lot of people who really don't like horror movies had that thing where they just saw one horror movie and it ruined their lives.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. That should be a question that I add next time is like, what horror movie ruined your life? Although I think it's harder for a horror movie fan to find one perhaps, but.
But you could take that question in so many different ways too. Like it could be ruined your life in a good way, so to speak. Like
that's true.
Because sometimes you'll just watch one that completely breaks your brain. It feels like for a little bit, and that's all you can think about.
Yeah, and I think maybe this one that we're about to talk about falls a little bit into that category. So who's your ultimate final girl, Jamie?
Oh my gosh, that one is really difficult. I'm going to go with a really just kind of, a little bit out there one. The first two that sprang to mind was Maddie from Hush and Michelle from 10 Cloverfield Lane.
Oh, both excellent choices, and both you're like bringing all the new takes to the Scaredy Cat 5 today. I like it.
I have a lot of just niche type, like they're inoffensive, but they're so niche, and I sit back and I'm like, I said this on Twitter, and again to echo Derek, possible RIP there. somebody would inevitably get mad about it, but I have some of the most benign takes. They're just niche.
So why the two of them?
I really honestly relate to Michelle on a deep level with the fact that she's just trying to face up to a lot of her personal trauma, and she's just so dang clever. and so smart, and she's got a wonderful amount of character depth. And then there's Maddie, who I feel the same way. I feel like she's also very smart and has a lot of like great character depth, and it's shown in these moments that people might not really consider because they're smaller moments. And I love the idea of how Maddie uses what people would consider a liability in a situation like that as one of her greatest strengths in the end.
I love that. How long would you last in a horror movie?
I think, and I have my mother again to think about this, I think I would probably last till the end because I grew up with this. I know a lot about the pitfalls. I guess you could say that I would be that genre savvy character.
Nice.
But I think I would make it till the end because I relate. I know the final girl is your audience surrogate a lot of the times, but I think that I relate to quite a few of them on like a personal level. So I think I could make it to the end, but again, you know, you can never tell.
That's true. I mean, there's always that person that you're like, oh, this is going to be our final girl. And then she's not. So,
oh my gosh. And that every time that happens, I'm going to call out the 2006 Black Christmas for this, because when you said that, I was like, when I first watched that, I was convinced Mary Elizabeth Winstead was our final girl.
And yeah,
she wasn't. And I was very confused.
Is that maybe because retroactively we live in a world where if Mary Elizabeth Winstead is in your movie now, she is the final girl, whereas in 2006, that wasn't necessarily the case?
Well, here's the thing. I was thinking about that because prior to that, you have Final Destination 3, and her ending there is ambiguous. And so I think maybe coming off of that, because I was obsessed with Final Destination 3. I think coming off of that, that's part of why I was so convinced of that, honestly.
That's fair. It reminds me of Sorority Row, and I've only seen it once. I just watched it recently, and I can't remember the names of the characters, but there was one person that I was like, she's my final girl, and she was not the final girl, and I was very surprised by it.
Was it Jamie Chung's character? That,
maybe?
I'm like, she's kind of the only one who would, I think, fall into that.
Yeah, because she was a little bit more savvy than some of the other girls.
Yes. She is the one that I thought would be the final girl and was not. Very disappointed. Although I loved that movie way more than I thought I was going to.
Listen, it's written by the same guy who wrote Piranha 3D. You're just getting excellence. You know you're getting excellence.
It's true.
I think it's so indicative of that time period in such a fun mm-hmm. way. It's such a great little capsule piece. And I'm here for the resurgence of praise this is getting because, again, analytically, reevaluation is very important to me with art. And I love that more people are discovering this and having fun with it because I showed my best friend, I was like, you're going to love this because it is so 2009 and it's right up your alley. There's camp. It's catty. I was like, you're gonna love it, and of course she did.
It was great. I had a similar experience where a friend was like, you need to watch Sorority Row, like, and that's his thing, like slashers particularly, you know, like 90s and 2000s slashers are what he loves. And so I was like, all right, I'm gonna trust your judgment, although there are some movies that I find questionable of his. But it was fantastic. It was so much fun. All right. Well, are we ready to talk about Lake Mungo? Yeah.
So ready.
All right. So the Letterboxd summary, after 16-year-old Alice Palmer drowns in a local dam, her family experiences a series of strange, inexplicable events centered in and around their home. Unsettled, the Palmers seek the help of psychic and parapsychologist, who discovers that Alice led a secret double life. At Lake Mungo, Alice's secret past emerges. I feel like that's the most misleading summary I have ever read.
I mean, yeah. One, because, like, it kind of spoils the reveal that happens more than halfway through the movie.
Mm-hmm.
But also because it's not really a movie about Alice, you know?
No, it's not. Yeah.
It's about her family. And, you know, this movie is often described as a movie, you know, about grief and loss. And that's true. Like, that's just, it is. I think the more interesting way to look at the movie, however, for me personally, is that this is a movie about guilt. Particularly if you look at June, the mother's final lines in the movie. Mm-hmm. And also her mother's character, the character of Iris. I think there's a lot there. And the whole character of the father, Russell. I think this movie, you know, the obvious theme is grief and loss. But then you have some really interesting stuff about guilt as well, which leads to a really surprisingly dense movie for how, you know, low budget and contained it feels.
Mm-hmm. So do you remember the first time that you saw it and kind of like, did you have any expectations going in? And, you know, what your initial thoughts were afterwards?
I saw it during, I think, back in the early days of the pandemic. And I know that I'm just like, I'm trying not to sound too wistful, but I did sit and watch a lot of really good horror movies during that time, because what else was I going to do for the first time? And then I was like, you know what, I'm going to sit down and watch this. And I typically go in with no expectations on found footage films, because my mileage varies a lot with found footage. It's either something that I really dig or something that I'm indifferent to or at the end. So I was like, I'm going to try this. I think that this could be something good. And Mary Beth McAndrews raves about it. She's written quite a bit about it. And I was like, you know what? Mary Beth and I have some similar taste. I'm going to try it out. And that's what happened for me.
I had seen the first 20 minutes like 5 or 6 years ago. And for whatever reason, just never finished it. So the first time I watched this movie was last night.
What?
I love that. I love everything about that. Right.
So do I.
Like, I saw the first 20 minutes. For some reason, oh my God. That's so relatable, though, because sometimes you just need some weird impetus to finish something.
And it had always, you know, I had watched it because I had heard of it, you know? And I think I must have just probably gotten tired, and then just, it eventually got taken off of Prime, so I didn't ever finish it. And then, so I actually had to rent it last night because it's not on Prime anymore. Which I say that like, oh, it was such a big, it was $4. Like, it was. And I had wanted to watch it since, because I've heard even more people talk about it in the last couple of years. And, you know, finally, you know, by committing to this, however long ago, I knew that it would be a good excuse to finally actually sit down and really experience the movie the whole way through. And I ended up watching it with my dad, who just wouldn't go to bed. So I was like, well, you can stay, but you have to be quiet.
Okay, so now I need to know, what did your dad think of it?
He thought it was really, really good. He, I don't remember the exact words he used, but I don't think he knows the term found footage, so he talked about it more as like a documentary, and he was like, you know, it felt really true to the documentary genre, the conventions of that genre and the style. Mm-hmm. So he actually, like, I think like maybe 30 minutes in, he asked me, he was like, is this real? Like, is this a documentary? And so I was like, no, it's a movie. But for a good chunk of the movie, he wasn't sure.
Wow, that's, I think that's a testament. I saw an interview, and there aren't many interviews with Joel Anderson, the writer and director. And he, this is the only feature film he has made. In fact, I think he's only made one other short, and he's kind of disappeared. But he, that was one of the things that he said. He wanted somebody to be able to turn it on in the middle of the night and kind of come into it in the middle and not know, is this real or is this a documentary? So mission accomplished, I think. That's awesome.
I actually think it's a little bit of a miss. It's a little misleading to say this is found footage.
Mm.
I think the found footage genre requires a little bit of, I think it's just a little different. I think it's closer to like truly to a mockumentary.
Yeah.
Like found footage is, I think the hang up of found footage is like, the footage was found, right? So, like, it's usually pretty unbroken, pretty, you know, unedited. And it's usually by characters who have disappeared. So, you know, it's like this was found in, like, an evidence locker or something. Whereas this movie is explicitly referencing that it is, like, made, right? It references that it is itself a movie in that it is presenting itself as a documentary.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not quite a found footage movie. I don't think it's like a crime to be like, oh, this is like on a list of 15 great found footage movies. It is important to note that if you go in expecting a found footage movie, this is not exactly what you're going to be expecting. It's a little different.
It's very hybrid in a way. Like, you have a lot of different mediums coming together for this one. And I know people, they call it found footage, but it's about finding footage pretty much.
Yeah, like literally.
Yeah, literally finding the footage.
Yeah. I mean, which you could argue, they do find some footage of Alice's. At some point in the movie. But yeah, the whole movie, I wouldn't say. It does kind of get lumped into that found footage format, but I think you're right, Derek. So it was released in 2008 and written and directed by Joel Anderson, as I mentioned already. It stars Talia Zucker, Martin Sharp, Rosie Traynor, and David Pledger. It premiered at the Sydney Film Festival on June 18th, 2008, and screened at the South by Southwest Film Festival in Austin in March 2009, followed by other film festivals like the Traveling Film Festival in, and the only reason I picked this one was because I wanted to say this, Wagga Wagga, Australia. Anderson wrote much of the film in 2005 because he had been working on something else, was having trouble getting funding for this other film because it was going to need a much bigger budget. And he kind of talked it over with some friends and decided to write a mockumentary, which would only require a small budget. And he said he doesn't think it's a supernatural thriller. He has referred to it as just an exploration of guilt and how technology plays with memory. During casting, they purposely picked low-profile actors to get more of an authentic feel. And it was shot over a period of approximately 5 weeks using different formats on video and film. But they also shot a lot of B-roll over a period of months prior to the start of actual filming, so that you get this feeling of a passage of time throughout the movie. Because the movie, I think, goes from, what, December to August? Is that right?
It's over several months. And I think that's funny that you mentioned that, because I was talking about how good the B-roll is earlier, because apparently I'm that kind of person. It's like, good B-roll.
The B-roll is gorgeous in this. Like, the different, like, landscape shots and just like, yeah, I agree. It's not something that I normally notice, B-roll. That's not who I am, but yeah, I definitely noticed it in this one. There's no actual written dialogue in the script. There was only a pretty detailed outline. And the actors had to improvise, with Anderson acting as the documentarian. So if you hear anybody asking questions in the movie, that is him. He is posing questions to the actors and allowed them to kind of answer how they wanted to. So Derek, you act. How would you feel about that? Are you like, would that be really difficult? I feel like that would be difficult as an actor. That was a stupid question that I just asked.
Yes, in that it is technically difficult. I happen to have a pretty strong improv background. And a lot of work at the University of Minnesota is about devising, which is very similar to what this is, like coming up with the story beats and really feeling out your character and just kind of speaking in the moment, you know, with whatever feels right to move the story in the direction it needs to go. So, yes, in that it is a specific kind of work that a lot of actors don't necessarily feel comfortable in or have training in, but because of my unique situation at my university, I think this would be the kind of thing that would feel very natural for me. Which is funny because this style of acting is called naturalism. It's very, very difficult. It's the same kind of acting that is employed in the Texas Chainsaw Massacre, actually, where it's not, you know, realism is what most movies, movie actors engage with. And that differentiates itself from naturalism. And at naturalist films like Lake Mungo, like Texas Chainsaw, their scripts are a little more bare bones. It's more about reacting. I mean, all acting is reacting, but it's about reacting like to what happens. It's about spontaneity. You know, it's about the jumps in sentences and the weird breaths you take and, you know, the ums and the pauses and leaning into how people actually talk and interact. So it's very, very difficult to pick up. So yeah, I mean, everyone in this movie does a really phenomenal job. It's quite the task to undertake, especially with so many characters. Yeah. Even characters who only have one scene. That's almost harder because you don't have as much information. You don't have, you know, as much time to work out all the kinks. Phenomenal job across the board, really, I think. But yes, it's difficult. No, I don't think I would find this particularly difficult.
Fair. It's funny that you talk about naturalism. I read quite a few reviews of the movie where people were like, the acting was wooden. And I was like, no, it wasn't wooden. It's just not what you are used to in a movie.
I'm just over here thinking about of how, of course, Derek and I have a similar acting background. And I'm just like, oh my gosh, everything you're saying, I'm like, yes. Naturalism. I was over here saying to myself, and thank God I had it muted. I was over here like Stanislavski.
Yes, I'm sure they all read an actor prepares before they took on this job.
Oh my God, this is what you get when you get somebody who has an English degree and a theater degree. And so I was just whispering Stanislavski to myself.
I mean, feel free to not be on mute when you have those little like side comments. I am good with that.
I was like, I don't want to be rude and like interrupt people, but I just am like Stanislavski, and I wax poetic about, you know, naturalistic acting all the time. My poor best friend is also my roommate. She gets the brunt of this all the time, and she's not shocked at all that I was sitting here like, yes.
I love that. So the budget for the movie was $1.7 million Australian dollars. Unfortunately, in the box office was only $29,850 Australian dollars. So reviews, though, were quite good, despite the kind of terrible box office. Variety's Russell Edwards called it an ambitious, restrained, and well-mounted mockumentary, and praised its musical score, critiqued the film's lighting, and apparent lack of scripted dialogue, which I think is interesting because I think both of those things are things that add to the authenticity of the film for me.
That's another thing that separates it from found footage. Found footage movies do not have scores.
Yes, true. Yeah, there's no score in Blair Witch.
Yeah, the only sound is or score would be ambience, like ambient music, like, or diegetic music, music that is happening in the scene. There's no traditional score. This movie has one, and that also kind of pulls it away from found footage into mockumentary. So I'm glad that reviewer picked up on that.
Andrew L. Urban of Urban Cinephile wrote, "This superbly constructed and executed film gets everything right to the smallest detail as it draws us into the imagined scenario. Quick Flicks called it a mournful, dreamlike examination of the hole left in the heart of a family after a death. I give it 5 stars out of 5 stars. The Hollywood Reporter talked about the film's compelling slow build, surreal atmospherics, and restrained soundtrack that works on a primal level and cleaves close to reality. The film was nominated for Best Horror Movie at the Fright Meter Awards in 2010. And a couple of Twitter thoughts. Tycho82 said, "Just rewatched this last week. The last bits are incredibly touching and beautiful the way they play out. Everyone's actions are insane, but also totally understandable. I love how once you think you know where it's headed, it goes in a completely different direction. A classic." And then Groove_SDC says, "It was beautifully creepy and ambiguous in all the right ways." There were a couple of negative reviews, or negative Twitter thoughts. I shouldn't say negative, just people that didn't like it that found it too slow, which I can see. Some people, it's not going to be their jam. The beginning of the movie, we start with kind of these old spirit photos. It looks like from Victorian times. And we meet the Palmer family, June, Russell, and their son, Matthew. We learn that 16-year-old Alice Palmer drowned while swimming with her family in Ararat and that her body wasn't found for a few days. The family is devastated, obviously, and they're trying to come to terms with her death in their own way. And 10 days after her funeral, weird things start happening in the house. June is having nightmares, totally understandable. There are weird noises throughout the house. Matthew ends up with mysterious bruises all over his body that no one can explain and that kind of resolve themselves within a few days. Russell sees Alice in her bedroom and has kind of this ghostly encounter with her. So Matthew decides to set up video cameras around the house after he captures what he believes is an image of Alice's ghost in the backyard. And through Matthew's video footage, we see that Alice is lingering in the house. So what do you do if you think you have a ghost? You reach out to a local psychic, in this case, radio psychic Ray Kemeny, for help. But he doesn't provide any insight to the hauntings. So far, you think you're watching a pretty straightforward ghost story. And then it takes a shift because we learn that Matthew has been staging the ghost sightings when he's caught on film at the dam wearing Alice's jacket. Did you see that coming? Did you see that the hoax coming?
I kind of felt it. I think a little bit in my bones, because there was something, I don't know what, I don't know if this was intentional on the actor's part. He just had a very untrustworthy thing about him to me. Because I don't know how to put this, but he just, it just seemed like, again, with like guilt, like he was also carrying around guilt, and like, of course, grief and guilt make you do some weird mm-hmm. things there. So I kind of had the idea that that might happen. I wasn't necessarily shocked by that so much as I was everything that came after.
Yeah, what's interesting is that I was thinking about it from a purely construction standpoint. I knew something was up because we were too early in the movie to be having all these big revelations. So I was like, something isn't adding up. And I didn't, you know, I didn't have an idea on what that was exactly, but I knew there was something else going on because it's simply too early to like play all your cards.
Right.
Yeah, that's a great observation there with that one. Definitely.
I did not see it coming at all. So I just kind of took it for what it was. And then I was genuinely shocked when that was revealed. But I'm also super gullible. So, you know, that's no surprise to me. You might think, why would he do that? Like, it seems like it would just cause the family more pain. But you have to remember, he's a teenage boy. And June is not quite convinced that Alice is dead, because she didn't see the body. Russell had identified the body, and she's like, maybe it was somebody else, because he even said that it didn't look like her.
I want to clarify. It's not that, like, I saw the hoax coming, but I saw like some weird development coming. Oh, okay. I was taken aback by the hoax, but as soon as Russell, and taking this one step further, I'm glad you just said this. As soon as Russell saw the body and June didn't, I knew that was going to cause mm-hmm. that there was going to be tension there. There was going to be something, some development related to that. I didn't know it was going to be connected to the pictures. So that definitely, that aspect of it did kind of surprise me for sure. But like, I knew that like, it wasn't as simple as
right.
we were being told it was.
I think that I kind of didn't realize how deep the hoax was going to go, because you don't really think about teenage boys moving mirrors around, and like the extent of it was just honestly awe-inspiring. If that had been my kid, I would have been like, I'm mad, but I'm also kind of impressed.
Yeah, you have a future in filmmaking, young man. I watched it last night, then I watched it again today. And when I was watching it today, I picked up on something that I hadn't picked up on my other watches. When they're talking to the owner of the business that Matthew works for, which is where he picks up kind of these, where he learns more about photography, the owner says something about Matthew having like a lot of skill and a lot of talent. And so like that maybe should have been a clue that, oh, he's saying that he's got a lot of skill. And so this could be something that he's using to fake these ghost events. But I never put it together.
I love it because it's presented in such a mundane way mm-hmm. that you're not going to pick it up until you watch it again. And I think that's a little bit of the magic of the film, is that everything is presented in such a cut and dry, mundane way. And then when you go through, you're like, oh, okay, that was right there in front of us.
Mm-hmm. It's funny you say that, because it literally, my next note was that the way that they reveal the hoax is so matter of fact. It's just, it's not, there's not a big uproar. There's no like, you know, finger pointing or recriminations. It's just, I don't really know what he was thinking. Like, I don't know why he did this. And then they just kind of go on. So the explanation that's given is that Matthew believes this may give the family a reason to exhume the body, confirm that it is indeed Alice, and then everybody can move forward. They do exhume the body. It is verified that it is indeed Alice. And Matthew ends up going away with Ray for a few days. Ray the psychic. Which initially I thought was kind of weird. I'm like, why are they letting their teenage son go away with this man that they have they barely know? But then when you look at the way that people who are grieving connect with psychics, and they feel this, they're just so intertwined with them. Like I could believe that they'd be like, yeah, you know what? It's okay for him to go away with Ray.
Yeah. Because again, grief makes you do weird things and takes you down some weird roads you would not imagine. And yeah. Yeah, that's like a spot on interpretation for me there.
So they keep the cameras rolling while Matthew's away, and they actually capture more images of Alice, ones that he couldn't have fabricated. So June wants to like figure this out. So she keeps watching the videos, and she sees that one of Matthew's videos shows an intruder in the house. The intruder turns out to be their neighbor, Brett Toohey, and he is caught on tape searching Alice's room. So Alice used to babysit for Brett and his wife. They have two young sons, live next door. So June wants to know what he's looking for. And she discovers a videotape of Alice in a sexual encounter with Brett and his wife. So it's not really clear if it's consensual or not. It seems kind of coerced. Either way, she's 16. They're adults. It's super icky.
Yeah, and there's just something so nauseatingly stilted about it on mm-hmm. Alice's part, which really lends to the idea of it being coerced. And it's like almost like she's crying at one point.
Yes.
They're showing footage of that. Like she's like uncomfortable. And it just, that really gets to me, that mm-hmm. part right there, because it's just, ugh. And I couldn't... And you kind of have to sit back and think about finding that if you were the parent in this situation, like that would, I mean, how do you deal with that?
Yeah, that would be devastating. Like the dad says, like at one point he's asked, like, what would you do if you saw him? And he's like, I would throttle him. If he were around the corner, I would throttle the man. And I think Russell, for some reason, really gets under my skin. June is more obviously grieving, whereas Russell is he seems very stoic about it. And I don't know, there's just something about Russell's character that just really like hurts my heart. So Alice was keeping a lot of secrets. It seems, in fact, one of her friends says something like Alice was keeping secrets about keeping secrets. And then we get another revelation because we discover that Alice had met with Ray, the psychic, before her death. So she'd been having dreams about her death and her subsequent haunting of the family home. And then Alice's boyfriend comes forward with mobile phone footage of a school trip to Lake Mungo. And in the footage, we see Alice doing something that at first isn't quite clear, but then we see that she's burying something at the foot of a tree. So, of course, the Palmers want to know what she buried. They head to Lake Mungo. They find the right tree, and they find what she buried, which was her phone and some personal belongings, like her watch, a ring, and I think some other things as well. And the footage on the phone is eerie, on her phone, because we see Alice walking by the lake. And something keeps coming closer and closer. We really can't see what it is until it's very, very close. And the figure is Alice, but it is the corpse version of her, bloated, disfigured, just as we saw her after her body was recovered from the lake.
That is another one of those parts that's just, it's so well done. Because they really, I think for that, they really do lean into the found footage stuff. And that's kind of why I think a lot of people have a hard time categorizing this one. But it's just the idea of your bloated, waterlogged corpse coming towards you is disconcerting, to put it lightly.
Yeah. And that's really the only big scare in this movie.
I think there's one other one, but I'll wait to talk about that.
Oh, okay, okay. I'm excited to hear.
But I agree. It is. I think the most obvious scare as we think about scares as moments in horror movies. This is definitely, I think, the most obvious conventional scare, and yes. It is a great scare. For sure. Because it's someone walking towards the camera. The reason it's a great scare is because it's such a normal thing that turns horrifying once you realize what is happening.
That's a really good point.
Alice is clearly unsettled, right, while filming it. But because it's on a 2005 Nokia phone, it takes us a while to catch up. But it already lends that air of, like, what's happening. And then when we finally realize what's going on, it's already right there, right?
Surprisingly, this gives the Palmers some sense of closure. I feel like if it were me, this would not give me a sense of closure. But it works for them. They decide to move out of their house. They think the haunting is now over.
I think I would lose. I would lose it. I think,
right.
Yeah, because I'm like, oh, this is giving us closure. I would just be like, what? Why did this happen?
Why did this happen? How did this happen? It would not give me closure. But they think that the haunting's now over. Alice's secrets have all been revealed. And just in case you didn't think that the movie had been devastating enough already, we see that Alice is still haunting the house. And as the family takes one last family photo from the yard, Alice is watching from the window. The credits roll. It's intercut with footage we have already seen, but now we see Alice in the footage, not where we had previously focused on, and she's been haunting the family all along.
And I think that is just so brilliant, and that I think might be one of my favorite details about it, is that Alice was there all along. So while her brother was faking a haunting, there was also an actual haunting going on, and I mean, it just, that's a really interesting way to take it, I think.
Yeah. Okay, so before we talk about kind of your favorite scenes, best scares, anything about the plot you want to talk about?
I'm going to, again, say something from a construction point, if that's all right. This is a very well-constructed, tight story. And I think that's important, especially as it functions. For those of you familiar with theater and playwriting, there is a genre of plays called memory plays. This somewhat functions as that, as many documentaries do, in that we are being told a lot of stories about the past, and we're being shown minimally that. And I think when you have that set up, you need to have a really, really clear idea in what you're trying to do. And I think this movie knows exactly what it wants to do. And so that makes it really compelling, even though technically a lot of questions don't get answered.
Then you're really relying on the, as you said, you're hearing people talk about things, relating things that happened in the past, but you're not seeing it. So it is very much open to, you know, the curse of the unreliable narrator. So you're only seeing, and we see it throughout the movie, right? Where they're talking about Alice and they are talking about her as they knew her, but we learn that they don't really know Alice as well as they think they do.
And yeah, and I have to cop to something. Like, I know anyone who has a theater degree is going to be like, well, Derek, that's not exactly what a memory play is. I know. But I also think if you think about what I said, you'll understand why I made the comparison. it's not about tell, don't show, but it's about the unreliable narrator aspect. It's about the how memory is fallible, mm-hmm. and moldable. It's very, you know, it's this thing we don't really understand a lot about and that can be manipulated. And so in that way, I think it's very similar to a memory play. A memory play, for context, usually is actually the opposite of what I said, tell, don't show. It's reliving, you know, memories through the perspective of one specific main character.
Okay.
So then there's a tinge of unreliability there because it's how this person remembers it. And it's called that because they don't cast different actors for different ages. The same actor plays the character at all stages of their life. I think a good example of this in film would be the 2019 Little Women, where the main actresses play the both the young versions and the old versions. A lot of people complained about Florence Pugh being 12-year-old Amy, but Greta Gerwig has a background in theater, and I have a background in theater, and I saw what she was doing there. So I think that's a more exact comparison. And also, it's about the unreliability of memory, because at the end of that movie, we see them as actual children, even though the whole time we're looking at the story through Joe's eyes, we see them as their adult selves, just acting like children. And I think that's the important connection to memory plays, not the literal, like, parameters right. of that medium. It's more about the thematic implications.
Let's talk about our favorite scenes.
I just have one that we haven't talked about. So I was like, I'll go first because it'll be quick. It is the scene where June goes to her final consultation with Ray. And they do a mini hypnosis thing where she imagines herself walking through her house.
Mm-hmm.
That is intercut with the second half of a scene we've already seen, but with new information. This is when we realize that Alice's haunting is ultimately a cycle and never ending. At least that's one way to look at it, because it's intercut with scenes from Alice's secret consultation with Ray that she did before she died. And he had her do the same exercise, which we saw a little bit of her describing the house and walking through it.
Yeah.
But this time we see the second half of that conversation where she describes herself in her room and she feels her mother coming into the room as the mother is imagining herself going into the room, but she doesn't see Alice.
It's so heartbreaking. Like, literally, as you're talking about it, Derek, I have chills. Like, just because it's so sad and so heartbreaking, because they're in the same place and yet they cannot connect.
I mean, if anything sums up what Lake Mungo is, I think this scene really is it.
Yeah, it's, oh my God. That was actually one of the scenes that I have listed as well. And I think it's because it the movie does funny things with time and with place. And I think the reason that, and I've been trying to work my way through it, the reason that it's called like Mungo and that pivotal scene happens in like Mungo is because that's where some of the earliest human remains have been found, I believe. And if anybody is an Australian history or like an anthropology expert, please correct me if I'm wrong. You know, the fact that they go back to this earliest point in human civilization, human life, and there's this weird thing happening with time. And you know, we have Alice talk, seeing her death, seeing herself as a ghost. Like it really does sum up the movie perfectly.
I was going to say, I love the disorienting quality of it and the parallelism.
It's kind of a gotcha a little bit to non-Australian audiences. Because mm-hmm. if you're like me, you assume Lake Mungo is the little dam they were swimming in that she drowned in.
Right.
And then when it's revealed that that's not what Lake Mungo is, that's not why this movie is called Lake Mungo. I've had this moment a couple times, you know, where the title of the movie really kind of kicks into gear when you realize something. I had this with Barbarian recently. There's other ones, but for some reason, the only one I can think of is Barbarian, where, like, once you realize what Barbarian means in the context... Oh, Malignant. That's a huge one. Once yes. you realize what Malignant means yeah. in the context of the story, it is a brain-breaking mm-hmm. moment. Barbarian 2, though, for sure.
Yeah.
And the fact that those movies get cited against each other in terms of like being very similar, for if you enjoyed Malignant, you'll probably like Barbarian. Like, it is an interesting aspect there as well. But mm-hmm. This I think also fits there, like when you realize as a foreigner, when you realize what the significance of Lake Mungo actually is, it's a little bit of a oh, it's all it like something's clicking moment.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Jamie, what about you? What are some of your favorite scenes?
Again, the one Derek mentioned, I really, and I mean, I know this probably sounds like very odd, but I absolutely love the artistry in the lake video right there, because it is so haunting. And but I think my favorite part is the end and just that emotional quality it has, and how the entire just revelation of her not moving on is there.
She's stuck there. They're going to move on.
It kicks it up a notch because you're just like, oh my God, y'all, your work's not done yet. She's still there. And I think the idea of that really, again, as you all said, parallels with the idea of how it's so much about not being seen. And I kind of thought about it from a perspective, like, you know, how many like suburban families don't really see their teenage daughters, like, mm-hmm. like really see them as, you know, as people, and don't really know them, and just how a lot of stuff, how, you know, a lot of people, we have our secrets and stuff, and we carry that so well, and there are parts of us that we hide away and we don't show. Like, there's a lot there about just human nature inherently, but also I feel like there's something about shame, because it feels like Alice was just carrying an insurmountable amount of shame over events that weren't her fault. Stuff that she completely, just the stuff with the neighbors, it really, it's heartbreaking. There's no other way to put it. It's just heartbreaking, because it's like she couldn't even come to her parents. And that's the goal as a parent. You want your kids to come to you when they need help. And I can't, because I've always been able to come to my parents, and that just really hurt to watch her have those experiences that an adult would have trouble processing, let alone a 16-year-old girl. And it just gets you.
It really does. Yeah. And I think to your point, yeah, like she's dealing with the stuff with the neighbors. She's dealing with the what she sees at Lake Mungo. Like, so there's so much. And the fact that as far as we're aware, like, her friends weren't aware of any of this. Her boyfriend wasn't aware. You know, nobody knew all of these things about her. She had nobody that she could go to. So I think you're right about that weight of guilt and shame that she has on her. I think that's a very good point. One of my favorite scenes that we haven't talked about, it's the tiniest little scene. I don't even think it's 30 seconds. And it's just something that I wanted to highlight because I thought it was really, really powerful. And it is something that again, this is a movie that does really well on rewatches because it's not something that it even crossed my radar the first time I watched it. But the scene where the family is driving back from the dam. So after Alice's body is recovered, they're driving back from the dam. It's almost a throwaway scene. The car stalls, and the only way they can drive home is in reverse. So we just see this car driving at night backwards because they're going back into the past. They're not going to be able to move forward until they can get some closure. And it's just this tiny little snapshot that I think perfectly encapsulates the fact that they are now stuck in the past. And until they get this closure, until they resolve, you know, their issues, they can't move forward. And then when you tie that in to that end where you're like, Alice isn't moving forward, Alice is still stuck in the house in their past, and yet they're moving on. Like, it just adds a new layer of heartbreak, I think.
Also, I noticed that too on my rewatch, because it's also kind of plays with the idea of the time loop not being being just absolutely unnatural, because she's seeing her future self in her present too. So there's a lot of stuff that's messed up with the timeline right there. So I was thinking about that as a reference to the timeline also.
All right, Derek, I'm eager to hear what your best scare is, or what one of the big scares was. Not big scares, one of the other scares that you were talking about is.
Yes. I actually think the best scare in the movie is right after the credits start. The first picture that we are shown is, it's actually not a picture. It's the video clip of Matthew walking from the living room to the front door, right? Mm-hmm. And it's a picture that, in fact, we've already seen zoomed in to a different part of the picture where the neighbor was. And then we are shown a third thing, that Alice was there. And then we see the backyard photo, and we see the manipulated Alice, but then it zooms into the corner and Alice was there. I think the credit photos are actually some of the scariest things that happened in the movie. Yeah. And yeah, I think it's particularly the ones that aren't the ones we saw that they already revealed Alice was also actually in. The fact that Alice was really in everything the whole time. Mm. I mean, what a reveal.
Yeah.
She permeated everything, and I'm like you, it's scary to think about that. And she, gosh, just I have chills thinking about it. Actually, it just, that just, again, it hits you in the face pretty much.
Yeah. It's so masterfully done, like the misdirection in some of the shots where they're showing those things that you're talking about, Derek, but you don't see them the first time and you see them in the credits. The misdirection is just absolutely incredible. They just do such a great job of being like, oh no, don't look over there. And I was listening to a podcast about it earlier today. And one of the things that they mentioned, and I don't know if you've seen it, it's a YouTube video, and they're like, okay, so there's some people playing basketball, and they're like, count how many times the basketball has passed. And so have you seen this video?
No, I don't think so.
I highly recommend it, although now I'm going to ruin it and tell you about it. But so they say, count how many times the basketball has passed. And so you're counting how many times the basketball has passed. And then they play the video back and they're like, did you see the gorilla? And there's literally a man in a gorilla suit that walks by, and you don't see it when you're watching because you've been told.
Yeah.
You've been told to watch that basketball. So it's interesting, though, the way they're like, oh, look at this person in the corner, but don't look at what's over here. So good. So well done. Yeah, I think I don't think there's any other real scares that I can think of. Jamie, any that you can think of that you want to mention? Other than obviously we talked about the big one.
I wanted to say that also kind of goes with the unreliable narrator thing, because they can only report what they perceive.
Mm-hmm.
So they are completely unreliable in a way that's not their fault . And I was like, oh yeah, that goes with the unreliable narrator thing. Really, I think that covered it for me, except there is that shot of, again, earlier on of Alice's poor body. And I saw somebody talk about how that would be an ethics problem if you really did that in a documentary. And I thought about it and I was like, yeah. And just the makeup and the whole look there is, it's brilliant, but it's not something you want to stare at for too long.
No. All right. Well, I'm eager to hear about the emotional impact that this had on you. We've talked a little bit about it. You talk about guilt a lot. Let's talk about that a little more.
One of the most obvious ways into this discussion about guilt is through the two things. The first is obviously Matthew's manipulation of the video and photos. He, I think, is struggling once he's done that. He's struggling with his motivation, because his motivation is good, but it's also harmful. You know, he's trying to help his family cope, but anyone who's done even a little bit of psychology reading, like theory reading, knows that coping mechanisms can be incredibly, incredibly harmful to the people who use them. And prolonging his mother's hope just because he knows that reality will come crashing in is a hard gambit to make, right? And I'm not using this as a way to put blame on him, right? I'm just saying I think that's probably a lot of considerations he had to make, and I think that comes through with him. He is the character who I think most obviously deals with guilt earliest in the movie. I think by the end, we realize that June is the one who is most obviously racked with guilt.
Yeah.
But it takes a while to get there. And then Russell's discussion of him viewing the body and June not, I think that's how his guilt manifests. He understands that because she didn't see the body, she really can't accept that Alice is gone.
Mm-hmm.
And it was such a simple thing to, like, no, we both have to do it, you know, to just make that. If he could have reached out. And again, I'm not saying this as from an outsider perspective. I'm trying to understand their thought process. So I'm speaking from his perspective, that if he had just reached out, kind of pushed her to come along with him, then a lot of their pain, you know, could have been
mm-hmm.
done away with, especially because he talks about how invested he had become in the idea that it wasn't Alice. And he has that incredible line where he's like, he really just wanted it to be someone else, anybody else's kid, just anybody else's, not his.
Yeah.
He really, really, really bought into that, even though he knew it wouldn't turn out the way that he was hoping. He latched onto June's hope. And if he had just prevented that hope from sparking, it could have saved them so much pain.
And, you know, bouncing off of that, I would also feel guilty because I know you would, it's only human nature to be sitting there thinking, oh, I wish that this was just somebody else. I would also feel guilty for that too, as well.
100%. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Guilty for letting yourself get to that point, right?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Oh my God, I know what this is like. And I still wish it was someone else going, you know, going through it and not me. It's really tough. There's a lot of tough stuff in there.
Yeah. And there's that part where he says they left the porch light on and they still leave it on. And like, you just like, even though he knows, like you said, Derek, he saw her body. He knows she's dead, but he becomes so tied up in June's disbelief that he's like, let's leave this light on in case she comes home.
There's also that great scene at the end, or not at the end, but near the end, where Iris, June's mother, says, I could never give myself wholly to June, and I suspect June could never give herself fully to Allie.
Yeah.
And I think that's another guilt, right? The guilt of a parent that maybe they in some ways failed their child. And obviously sometimes that guilt is founded. Sometimes parents do fail their children. And sometimes children are just also people who have their secrets and their own lives and their own decisions that they make or situations they find themselves in that weren't necessarily things that could be stopped by parental intervention. And even with that consideration, you still feel guilty about it because it's your child and you're supposed to protect them, right? And that's another thing too, I think, that plays into it with Matthew, is a little bit like survivor's guilt. It's never clearly stated, I think, if he is younger or older than her. I in my headcanon of this movie, he is older than her.
Same. Yeah.
Yeah. That's how it reads.
Mostly because I am an older brother. So like to a sister. And so I definitely projected a little bit onto that. And I was thinking, I was like, yeah, I got it. I putting yourself in that headspace of like, if my, you know, little sister drowned and I was like right there when it happened, or like right there moments before it happened, I was like, it would, I think, not that my mind is, you know, so healthy to begin with, but I think it would break my mind.
And that's the thing. Like, I think because he was swimming with her. He came out a few minutes before and then said to their dad at one point, where's Alice? And then they couldn't find her. And I think he's so and I think, Jamie, you said something about how he just seems like he's kind of off, like there's something off about him. And I think part of it for me was that he feels guilty, A, about like the fact that he got out of the water and his sister drowned moments afterwards, but also that he's, you know, she's 16, so he's probably, what, 17, 18, and he's dealing with these things that he shouldn't have to deal with on top of the guilt. And then he's also feeling guilty about this, the hoax that he is concocting. So it just all adds up to me. But I do have a question because I read some fan theories today. Oh,
I was wondering if we were going to get theories. I have one of my own, but you can start.
Okay, so I was just going to say, so one of the biggest fan theories that I heard was that Matthew killed her. And that's why he felt guilty. And that's where the bruises came from. And that's also kind of why he, like, so when you look at the footage, often it's like Matthew behind the film, behind the camera, like the family footage before the tragedy. And it often focuses on her, which could also be editing. It can just be editing the way that the filmmakers like decided to edit, because of course she's supposed to be kind of the focal point seemingly of the movie. But okay, so that's my theory. I don't think that. I don't think that he killed her. I think she just drowned in a terrible accident, but I wanted to know what your thoughts were.
So there's two things that come to mind when I think of this theory. Well, two things after. Yes, I understand how someone could come to that conclusion, but there's two reasons I don't fully buy it. I don't actually buy into it at all. I was just saying fully to like be nice. I don't really think it holds up for two considerations. One, in the Occam's razor, like looking at all the possibilities, there are so many more considerations that have to be taken into account for Matthew to be the killer than if you look at Brett, like, or like causing her to just be in a bad space where she lets herself drown, right?
Mm-hmm.
I think that's a little bit of a simpler explanation. with less clauses to account for. The other, wouldn't he have had the bruises after he left the lake if they were like
exactly
a manifestation of her fighting back that like reappeared? So that was like, as soon as that happened, I was like, as soon as I came across the theory, I was like, but the bruises, like, wouldn't they have been there the first time? Like, obviously not like right yeah. the second, but in yeah. the days following, I feel like his parents would have seen them.
Yeah, you're gonna notice, like, my daughter drowned, and oh my god, my son, he has these like hand-shaped bruises. Oh.
But even if your parent mind can't go there, you'd be like, something's going on with him. He had these weird mm-hmm. bruises, right?
Yeah. Like, it would, even if it didn't just, you weren't just like murder, you would just be sitting there like, something's not right, and I should probably do something about it.
Even if it's purely concern, right? Like, yeah. Yeah. So I think that would have been a point of contention in the film. And I agree, Sherry, that like, or I agree with the possibility you brought up that like, because Alice is the one who died, the family footage they show is going to be the stuff that revolved around Alice.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. So I think it's the simpler explanation. My theory, Brett and his wife ran when he couldn't find the tape. And
yes.
they knew that that was really kind of the, I think, straw that broke the camel's back in regards to Alice accepting her impending death.
Yeah. Because she knew that they would never be held accountable.
Not while she was alive.
Yeah, not while, exactly.
Because when she's alive, they can continue to manipulate her. They can continue to manipulate the story. Her death, actually, somewhat ironically, is the thing that stops that. And I'm not saying that she had to die for everything to be all right, but yeah. what I am saying is, as a 16-year-old, sometimes 16-year-olds are so tunnel visiony, it feels like the only way to solve the problem is the way that I've convinced myself is unavoidable.
Mm-hmm.
And mm-hmm. it ultimately ends up creating a cycle of almost reincarnation.
Like a self-fulfilling prophecy.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because, like, her seeing the corpse could have just as easily been interpreted as a warning as yeah. it was a calling of sorts.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a very good point. It didn't have to necessarily end in her death, but
it did. But
because it did, she felt, I think it did because she felt that was the only way she could get justice. And then look what happened. She didn't. I mean, the truth is out. Justice wasn't really served, and her ghost will continue to haunt the house.
Yeah. I hope, though, because, you know, there's that little scene with the police officer, and they're like, we've been trying to track them down, and I'm like, I hope. I know movies don't exist after the end of the movie, after the credits end. However, in my mind, I'm like, they find her. They find them.
This movie does actually happen to exist after
That's the credits. That's true. Like, very good point.
I can't believe we didn't bring that up at all, though. Yeah, this is much like a Marvel movie. This movie has a post-credit scene, guys.
What? Wait, it has a post-credit scene?
Yes.
How have I not seen that? Okay, tell me more.
That's what I was talking about when I said this movie exists after the credits stop rolling.
I thought you just meant, like, because, like, she's still haunting the house.
It's at Lake Mungo. You see Alice or her doppelganger. It's nighttime, it's in the darkness, it's not found footage. You see Alice standing at Lake Mungo, and then like lightning strikes.
That's just, I need to watch that. So eerie.
Yeah, go back. Sorry for spoiling what it was. No, already. That's but okay. It's a pretty haunting visual if you want to go back and experience the movie in full.
I'm gonna do that like post haste, like, you know, that when this is over, I'm going straight to it, and then I'll probably Same. Pop into your messages screaming. It's just gonna be like, I watched it. I'm terrified, fully and completely bowled over by the. I love when non-Marvel movies have post-credit scenes like that, because you really don't expect that. With Marvel, you expect it.
Anything else you want to talk about the topic of guilt? Or, I mean, I feel like we've talked about grief and loss pretty thoroughly through our conversation, but anything about guilt you wanted to add?
I just kind of wanted to add on to what Derek said and what you've said about Matthew. What people are, I think, reading as him being a shifty murderer is just survivor's guilt again.
Yeah.
Like, how can you not feel like I was there too? Should have, you know, the whole dramatic thing that happens when you're like, take me. Why couldn't it have been me instead? And I think that's what is going on there. Because I kept thinking, I was like, oh yeah, this is just classic survivor's guilt. And that happened.
Yeah, I feel like people are just trying to put a JonBenet Ramsey spin on it, where they're like, it was the brother. Like, that's my theory.
Yeah.
The haters simply cannot let a hot older brother throw.
He cannot. He's not allowed to thrive. And yeah, I don't disagree there.
Yeah. He was a cutie, I think.
He looks very much of his time. Like, he's got that early 2000s haircut.
I was six when this came out. So that very formative imagery for me. He also looks a little bit like Adam Brody.
That's what I was thinking.
I can see that.
On the OC.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Like 2006 Adam Brody. And also, I thought her boyfriend was kind of a cutie too.
He was kind of a cutie. Yeah. Yeah. Very like boy next door cutie.
And the sister, I thought, was one of the, gave one of the best performances. The boyfriend's sister, Kim.
Mm-hmm. Oh, okay. Yeah. And she's not in it very much.
No, but she definitely was one of the supporting characters that stood out to me. Because I feel like it's easy to be like, oh, the June was so great, and Matthew was so great, and Russell was so great, Ray was so great. That's all true. But it's also, they are the cornerstone. Like, they are,
yeah.
Not the cornerstones, actually. They are the main characters. The movie really works because its supporting characters all feel... Yes. Real. And I think Kim was certainly one of the best examples of that in terms of performance. Bob Smeet, an icon.
Bob Smeet, yes.
So good. There was someone else who I thought was...
I liked the couple at the lake when they
Yes, yeah. Yes. They had really
turned out to be Bob Smeet.
A little bit of a rapport. Mm-hmm. It was it was really interesting. Especially, I loved when they were asked, do you believe in ghosts? And they're like, nah. I was like, yes. Yeah, these guys are great. So shout out to all the supporting actors in the movie.
Yes. And that's what I love about you, Derek, is that you notice that kind of stuff. And that is so, so cool, because a lot of people don't take the time to appreciate that. Emily, being Emily, just actually pulled up the end and fast forwarded, and it's there.
Nice. That's what I'm doing. Once we wrap up, I'm gonna put my Blu-ray on and see.
Yeah, because Emily always, she sits and listens to every podcast I've ever done.
Oh,
she gets and has. She's like, I get the firsthand experience pretty much. And she coerces the dogs into quietness. Like, she'll pat them if they get rowdy. She nannies them. And she was like, she got my remote because she's sitting on the edge of my bed, and she's like, I'm looking this up while everybody's talking. And then she goes, oh shit.
That's awesome. That is awesome. Well, I just wanted to talk a little bit about the format before we wrap up. So the format, we talked a lot about how it's got elements of found footage, really kind of a mockumentary. But do you think, so the cinematographer, John Brawley, said they were going for a feeling of truth. Do you think that they managed to achieve that with this, with the format and with everything, I guess?
I think Derek's dad's reaction to that really answers that question right there. It's like, yeah, it seems so, like, they have that format down pat. Like, they understand exactly what they're doing there. And everything, again, is so controlled and so contained. Mm-hmm. And it's taught And yeah, it feels real. The characters feel real. Like Derek said, the secondary characters feel very real also. There's some real mastery going on there, because it's like every little detail has been thought about and it has been put into place, but it's also very much, you know, informed by real life occurrences, not exactly seeing your dead bloated corpse, but you know, those feelings of grief and those feelings of guilt. So it's, yeah, there's truth there to it.
Mm-hmm. I have a question to put forward.
Yeah.
It's mm-hmm. a little bit of a gamey kind of question. So I'm going to list a few Australian horror movies that I'm very fond of.
Okay.
And I want to see if you guys can get what I think the connecting thread between all of these movies is.
Oh, gosh. Okay.
It's quite a list. So, obviously, Lake Mungo.
Okay.
Wolf Creek and Wolf Creek 2.
I had a feeling that that was going to be one. I felt that in my bones.
The Loved Ones.
I felt that. I knew that was coming too.
Wake and Fright.
Okay.
Bait and Rogue.
Oh, this is a really, this is a really good, oh my God.
I've never seen any of those. So Jamie, it's all you.
I've seen most of those, and Emily has by default seen most of those, because I force her to watch everything, and I like Australian horror. So, oh my God, she's over there whispering Xavier Samuel right now. But I know he's not, he's only in, Bait and The Loved Ones. I don't think he popped. I mean, that would be really funny if that was him. But I'm curious to hear the thread here.
Okay, so I think this can be applied to a lot of Australian horror movies outside of the ones I just mentioned. Mm-hmm. The reasons I brought up this specific list, though, is I believe they all engage in exploitation of location as their central kind of theme. They all are kind of isolation horror, not in the traditional literal sense, like something like Texas Chainsaw Massacre, more in that characters, even if they're in like a suburb or, you know, a more urban area, characters are limited to the places they go over the course of the movie. Mm-hmm. The location is part of what is scary. Mm-hmm. So, like, obviously in the Wolf Creek movies, the Outback is, like, just as dangerous as Mick. In The Loved Ones, the house that Lola and Daddy live in is... Yeah. It's a suburban house, but it's on a stretch of road that's very isolated, very far mm-hmm. away, hard to get to. And the house has its own horrors, obviously.
Oh, yeah.
In Rogue, they're chased to an island by a crocodile.
Mm-hmm.
Bait,
I feel like I need to catch up on my Australian horror films. Sorry to interrupt.
So good. Australian horror is really across the board quite good. But yeah, I think that's a theme of Australian horror movies. There's a lot. And Wake and Fright, the Outback, again, is a huge, huge aspect of... The scary, it's about how the Outback drives a man insane. So and it's also very gay. So Wake and Fright, huge.
You have recommendation. Got to write this piece. I'm gonna aggravate you till you do it. This is brilliant, actually. It's a really great synthesis of the horror cinema of a place. Like when you started connecting it all together, I was like, man, I'm just envisioning the piece that this would make, and like, it's beautiful.
Yeah, and it just ties into everything we know about like Australian like national identity, right? Like, so that's, I like it.
It's like a more macro version of regionalism almost.
Yeah, because it's the whole continent.
Yeah, it's like, because usually with regionalism you think of the little pockets, and I was
big,
like,
big ass island.
This is like the macro version of it. It's like the whole thing.
Well, I think that applies to, like, you know, there's certain conventions in like European horror or Asian horror.
Mm-hmm.
North American horror even has its own identity. like Asia and Africa, North America is a pretty big continent. It spans a lot of cultures, a lot of climates. But there is something to, like, there being a North American identity to a lot of the horror movies that come out of here. South America, to what I can tell, I haven't seen as much South American horror cinema, but from what I can tell, there also seems to be sort of a continental identity there as well. So I think for Australia or Oceania, if you want to, like, get really technical, oceanic horror really seems to be about, like, the exploitation of location, and how the environment is part of what is dangerous.
I was going to ask, have you seen Sissy? Because that will definitely go into that.
I have not, but I've been wanting to.
Yes.
Yeah, same.
But it takes place in because it takes place in a very kind of secluded, like, vacation home off, and they use that to their advantage in the film and in quite interesting ways. And it also, it plays with in universe with people's perceptions. So I think that you definitely need to watch that one before you write that piece. And you are writing that because I'm going to display it, like, everywhere on social media.
I mean, it sounds like you've got the idea for a book, because, like, that could be, you know, that could be your chapter is the one about Australia, and then, like, break it down into, like, the different, you know, what each kind of continent or region, what their horror movies say about them.
And that would be, like, you could, like, turn it into a whole collaborative project too, like, start inviting people to you know, do their own chapters, and, like, the lead chapter be the Australia one, because it is the centerpiece, and it's brilliant. It's absolutely brilliant.
When that comes out, folks, you heard it here first. All right. Anything else you want to, any random thoughts you want to kind of mention before we wrap up?
I have one that I thought of earlier that was kind of funny, because that you were talking about the director saying that he used really low key actors and stuff. And I was like, yeah, that was probably the best choice, because I was like, could you imagine Hugh Jackman just showing up in, like, Mungo? Like,
Nicole Kidman as June.
Yes. And that's, if this had been a Hollywood produced movie, I guarantee you it would have been like Hugh Jackman and Nicole Kidman.
Naomi Watts is the coworker.
Yeah.
The religious coworker. Yeah.
All good actors, but, like, yeah.
Oh, like, for sure.
You need part of what, like, again, that's part of the convention for found footage and mockumentary, is, like, you need actors that aren't instantly recognizable, because you need to buy into this movie as reality, right? Mm-hmm. In a way that, like, suspension of disbelief doesn't work as well with found footage, because we're being sold as on it as an actual document. Whereas a regular movie, like, I can pretend that I don't know who Nicole Kidman is for the next, like, hour and a half or whatever.
Speaking of which, just to a little side note that I forgot to mention with the authenticity. So the scenes at the beginning of the movie with the news crew, the rescue divers, they actually recruited real reporters and real rescue divers to come in to film those scenes. They also made sure that they had appropriately aged technology. So when they were filming the family videos, or, you know, like, doing things like that, it would feel authentic. So you weren't like, this is supposed to be 5 years ago, but in fact, it feels like it was just shot yesterday with, you know, the newest cell phone or whatever. Yeah. So the level of detail that they put in to maintain that feeling of truth, I think, is just incredible.
It's like a less extreme version of what Robert Eggers did with The Lighthouse. It's not like you're filming on this ancient camera that if it breaks, you're screwed. But it's great. Great authenticity there.
And I would be remiss as a child of the 90s to not highlight the fact that there is a very strong Twin Peaks connection.
Yes.
With, you know, the Palmers, first of all, the name, the dead teenage girl, which, if you look at Alice Palmer's body, definitely resembles that of Laura Palmer. Mm-hmm. These kind of weird nightmares and things happening. definitely influenced by Twin Peaks and David Lynch. So, yeah. All right. So body count is one, unfortunately. Unfortunately, I was going to say, unfortunately, only Alice died. That's not what I meant. Unfortunately, Alice died. So what would your rating, if you had to rate this out of five scaredy cat screams, what would you give it?
You know, I gave it a 4, I think, on Letterboxd. And I feel good about that. But after talking about this, I do, for the purposes of this podcast, I'm going to give it a 5 because I think this movie knows what it wants to do and it does exactly that. So I'll keep my 4 on Letterboxd, but I'll give 5 here because I think that this movie had, you know, a lot on its mind and a lot it wanted to tackle. And I think it did everything it wanted to do.
I love it.
Yeah, it's definitely a 4 for me because I feel like there are limitations, but it's of no fault of theirs. But I also, it is so technically tight and just so well done that I think that it, and I hate to use the word elevates, but it kind of elevates it, overshoots any issues they have and kind of elevates it to a 5.
Awesome. Excellent. Derek, I'm glad that you liked the movie. I would have felt really horrible if you signed up to talk about a movie that you ended up hating on your first watch. So I'm glad you enjoyed it.
Derek is so fun when it's a movie he dislikes because, like, we've talked about ones that we just vehemently just dislike. And the way Derek goes about it, it's always just purely entertaining and there's no real malice behind it. So it would have been a very interesting, constructing conversation, I believe.
I don't think I've ever had covered a movie with someone that they didn't like the movie. And I feel like that is a missed opportunity.
I've covered 2 movies, I think. No, I've covered 3 movies on my own podcast that I did not like, 2 of which I absolutely hated. And so if you want to go listen to those, you can. It was Underworld Evolution and Freddy's Dead.
I knew it.
Hated them. Oh, Jamie knows how much I hate Freddy's
Every
Dead.
Time I see somebody praising it, I like kind of internally cringe for you because I'm like, oh my God. Yeah, it's like secondhand cringe. I'm like, oh no.
Freddy's Dead is one of the very few movies where, like, if I see someone praising it, I get upset.
Oh.
we all, and you might not respond. And if you do, it's respect. You're always so respectful about differences. And you're just like sitting there just quietly seething. Because that's how I am too, because I'm like, hey, if you like it, this thing that absolutely makes my blood boil, I mean, that, I guess that's fine, but I'm just gonna sit here and hate it silently.
If Twitter still exists, or on IG, I guess, whatever, watch the movie Trick. I think it's on Hulu.
We have been making plans to watch that forever.
I hate that movie, and I want to make sure I get. I'm sure Trick is. There's more than one movie called Trick, so I want to make not the 1999 gay movie. That love that movie. So Trick, directed by Patrick Lussier. It came out on October 18th, 2019. It stars Omar Epps, Tom Atkins, and Jamie Kennedy. Terrible, 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 terrible movie. Not a single good thing to say about it.
Really?
Actually, no. I have to say one nice thing about it because I'll feel bad. It's really fucking gory.
Okay. Okay. Like Terrifier gory?
No, not Terrifier gory. Okay. Okay. But not.
That's always my litmus test. If it's gorier or as gory as Terrifier, then
not Terrifier gory. But it is pretty brutal. So that's cool. But man, I was so. Like upset after I watched it. Like it truly ruined my day.
Oh no.
So if you ever want to have a really interesting fun conversation over DMs, anyone who wants to watch Trick subject themselves to that and then like DM me about it, like I I have thoughts.
Please do, because you're in for the time of your life. Like, some of the most impassioned discussion I've had with Derek is him talking about Trick and Freddy's Dead.
Now I feel like I know what I'm going to watch tonight. After watching that, you know, post-credit scene. Trick.
Watch the post-credit. No, save the post-credit scene of Lake Mungo till after Trick, so you have something to look forward to.
Oh, smart. I like that.
Yeah.
No, and unlike, here's the thing. Well, I don't love the first Terrifier. It's very much a nothing burger to me. Did really enjoy Terrifier 2. Thought it was so fun.
Really?
Yeah. I had a blast.
because I had the same reaction to the first one, so I might give the second same one a try. Yeah.
It's just there's not really like a story, you know? I mean, you guys have seen it. You know, it's like a series of random events, kind of.
Yeah.
And it's gory, sure, but like, it doesn't really mean anything. But the second one was a ton of fun. I had so much fun. Maybe it's because I got to see it in the theater. But I went with my best friend, Juno, who she loves Terrifier. And she also loved this one. So if you like Terrifier, or if you don't like Terrifier, you might like Terrifier too.
That's always interesting too, when it's like something that, because here's the thing, sometimes I will watch sequels to stuff just to see if I like it better.
Yeah.
Yeah, I've done that. I've also watched a movie that I didn't like a second time to see if, okay, maybe I just was not in the right headspace, and so I'll watch it again.
You know what movie I've been giving some space to do that to? The Howling. I didn't like The Howling the first time I watched it. And Juno and I covered it on our permanent hiatus podcast, but we covered The Howling, and we were both kind of like, eh, like it didn't really do anything for us. And there was some stuff we didn't like about it, so it ended up being a negative review. And I kind of was like a little disappointed, because I was like, I really wanted to like this movie. So I think 2-3 years ago. So hopefully one of these days I'm gonna give it another shot and see if I've evolved in any way when it comes to that movie.
I think that is one that does better on a rewatch. I feel like I didn't hate it when I saw it the first time. I liked it. I didn't love it, but it's watching it the second time, I definitely had a higher opinion of it.
And we love Dee Wallace so much.
Right?
It hurt us both a little bit to be like, sorry, Dee, we didn't.
Yeah.
But I think what's cute about that, because isn't I think her and
yeah, her husband's in it with her.
Yeah.
I saw where her daughter got to see it on the big screen for the first time, and she was like, "That's my mom and dad." And I was like,
her dad has werewolf sex in it.
Yes.
I mean, you know what? If you're gonna watch your dad have werewolf sex, you might as well do it on the big screen. Go big or go home.
Exactly. I think that's actually where they met, isn't it?
I feel
like they met on the set of that. Yeah, nice.
I think that's just so sweet. And honestly, that's kind of why I love movies on a personal level too, because, you know, that must be really special for the kids and stuff.
Thank you for coming on and talking about Lake Mungo today. It was a lot of fun. I didn't really pick up on the guilt as much as like the grief and loss. So you guys definitely gave me something to think about. And I can totally see it. So that's why I love talking movies with people.
Me too. I love seeing different perspectives and like how movies affect other people. Mm-hmm. And, you know, because I feel like I learn more not only about the film, but about myself there too.
Absolutely. So tell us where we can find you, your social media, anything that you have coming up, any current projects, that sort of thing.
Well, I don't have much, so I can go real quick. Yeah, you know, it's your boy Derek, and you should follow me on Twitter if it still exists, at DerekSykes17, Instagram at DerekSpooks, Letterboxd. I believe I am also DerekSykes17 on Letterboxd, but, or you can just search my name, Derek Sykes, DerekSykes. If we're friends, you know, or not, you can follow me on Be Real and TikTok at Derek Sucks. And projects, I have my thesis play in the spring. And
ooh, that'll I love be that.
Publicly performed. And I think I might also do a virtual reading that will be available to everyone online. So that will be definitely in May 2023. So that'll be kind of the culmination of my college experience and everything I've learned. It is a horror themed play, so that's exciting.
Love it.
So I'm going to maybe try and find a way to make that publicly available for everyone. If you would like to read the script, you can just DM me.
Derek, we should do a read of it.
Yeah, maybe after I do my presentation for grade.
Yeah.
Yeah, that would be cool.
Yes.
Oh, and I've got my Dracula script. I am adapting Dracula for the stage.
Yes. Well,
as a kind of a personal project that evolved. We were gonna put it on, and then a pandemic happened, and then a lot of those people don't live here anymore. But I'm still kind of adapting it as a passion project. I just picked it up a couple days ago after like 2 years of not touching it, and it's almost done now. And so that's also fun. If you wanna, we can maybe that's one we can talk about putting a reading on of.
I'm always excited for the stuff you're doing. You have such, you have such clear vision and such great understanding of the genre. And I just, it's always a joy.
I like to do public readings of my scripts sometimes. Usually they go over Zoom so I can have my friends who don't live in state. So I announce those on Twitter and Instagram when I do them. So you can watch out for that. And if you want to be involved or if you want to come watch, I think I'm going to do another one in January or February. So you can watch out for that. So I have mostly just things I'm writing, I guess, that I'm trying to make accessible to people if they would like to consume it. That's me. Follow me on, socials. I'm a fun person to follow.
I guess I should go do where you can find me. You can find me on the possibly sinking ship that is Twitter at Jamie A. Writes. I know it's not that creative, and I just couldn't think of anything, and I wanted to get it over with. And I've thought about changing it for years, but I'm just like, okay, I'm just sticking with it for right now. You can also find me on Instagram at Jamie Alvey, and you can also, I have a website to maintain some air of kind of, I guess, professionalism, jamiealvey.com. I try to keep it pretty simple so people can, find all that. And I am, doing a lot of my writing stuff. I have several pieces that are in editing right now that I'm waiting to come out. I took a little bit of a break from everything just so I could kind of clear my head and not burn myself out. But I am currently also working on a screenplay, and I'm so close to being done with it. And I just hope at some point that everybody gets to see these screenplays. That's one of the things, because I feel so weird talking about it, and people will go, where can I find this? And I'm like, well, for right now in my mind, but I'm here. And as you can find me, I'm an educator. If I'm not writing, I am at school, and I help advise the school newspaper. So I'm just surrounded by writing. Also, because I'm a glutton for punishment, I am going to get a second master's online in creative writing, because it's something that I always wanted to do. But I was like, you know what, maybe I should do it right now. And I'm going to do it.
That's awesome.
I was like, I'm not at a point where I want a doctorate yet. I just kind of want to, dabble some more. But yeah, I start in January, and I'm really excited.
That's fantastic. Well, thank you for joining us today. You can catch us, hopefully, on Twitter. I always feel like playing the song from Titanic, Not My Heart Will Go On. But the one that the band's playing when the ship's going down, as I keep talking about Twitter. But hopefully it's still around at Cat Scaredy, and on Instagram at Scaredy Cats the Podcast. I never showed out my Letterboxd account, but I will shout that out. You can find me there as Scaredy Sherry. and subscribe wherever you find podcasts. Don't forget to let us know what you think by leaving us a review. Until next time, stay scared.